in order to be considered on their way to becoming a different species. Subspeciation is a rather abstract, perhaps vague, concept. The condition for a subspecies, as with a fully different species, is prolonged isolation. It is difficult to assess the level and duration of isolation necessary to define a subspecies, and it is often unclear where a subspecies ends and a new species begins. Furthermore, applying the concept of subspecies to humans is problematic. Humans are never isolated from each other for long. Just think of all the broadcasters and photographers who continually search for the most isolated groups of humans and then report on them to the rest of the world. Humans have never been able to continue in a state of isolation long enough to support the concept of subspecies. Humans are a reportedly 99.997% genetically similar across all groups, making us exceptionally closely related compared to other animals. Finally, there is a simple logistical challenge in clearly diagnosing whether differences in races are at the level of different species. How would you go about proving it? Would you attempt to mix random pairs of humans just to see if they can interbreed? Clearly, this is not ethically feasible, and it would be incredibly costly, too. Such manipulation is also morally questionable when it pertains to species closely related to humans. For example, could we try interbreeding a human and a chimpanzee, just to find out whether they belong to different species? In the 1920s, during a particularly dark time in the history of biological sciences, one researcher, Ilya Ivanovich Ivanov, tried to create such a creature, a humanzee. Today, we can determine species relatedness through morphology and genomic comparison, without resorting to such crude methods. If two populations belong to the same species, they share the same gene pool and consequently will appear similar. We can see from far away whether we're looking at a human or a non-human animal. Although everyone looks different, humans share certain traits that differentiate us from other animals, and we know them almost intuitively. What if two populations become separated, and the state of isolation continues for a long period of time, ultimately leading to a separation of the gene pools? As time goes by, members of the two populations will start to look different. Since the populations do not exchange genes, the differences accumulate. As this situation persists, the two populations become different subspecies, and ultimately different species. This is why we can recognize different species by the different appearances between groups. The problem, however, is that there is no way to tell how much difference there should be for a different species. One of the classic questions in paleoanthropology is, are these two fossil specimens too different to belong to the same species? What we perceive to be different, for example, skin color, may or may not be substantial enough to indicate different species. Currently, nobody thinks different races are different species. Humans do possess varying traits across the globe, but the variation is distributed in such a way that different races cannot be delineated. Some traits match up with geographic distributions. For example, Asians have a higher frequency of shovel-shaped incisors. But other traits are distributed regardless of geographic groupings, or occur along a continuous spectrum such that there cannot be clear divisions. For example, skin color varies in a very gradual way. We cannot draw a clean and clear line that separates white skin and black skin. To take another example, some people can taste PTC, a chemical with an extremely bitter taste, and others cannot. But the tasters and the non-tasters do not align with any traditional racial classifications. Anthropologists have reached a consensus that race is not a biological concept, but a historical, cultural, and social concept. Neanderthals, Aborigines, and the species question. Applying this view to the debate on the origins of modern humans brings up an interesting question. How different did Neanderthals and the Upper Paleolithic Europeans, those considered to be the first modern humans in Europe, look? Did they look too different to be considered the same species? What if they looked different, but the level of difference was within the range of expectation for a single species? Then there would be no reason to classify them as a different species. We can devise ways to measure difference with quantitative rigor, but the question still remains, how much difference should there be for different species? Comparing Neanderthals with modern humans is no exception. Furthermore, when comparing Neanderthals with modern humans, the first thing we have to do is decide which population of modern humans to look at. And that is not a simple problem. Should the modern humans compared with Neanderthals include representative samples from all major continents? Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, and the Americas? How could a representative sample be defined? This question was formally debated some time ago. In the 1980s, two rivals, Christopher Stringer from the British Museum of Natural History and Milford Wolpoff from the University of Michigan, exchanged opinions about the definition of modern humans. Arguing that the debate about the origins of modern humans needs an accurate definition of modern human morphology, Stringer listed traits that could be used to identify modern humans. In other words, he proposed the conditions of being human. Except there was a problem. Applying those conditions excluded a significant portion of modern humans, such as the Australian Aborigines. Were they not humans too? Wolpoff argued against such a list because of its exclusive properties and racist implications. All living human populations today are clearly modern humans. Any list of human traits should include all living humans today, or at least most of them. What spurred such an absurd exchange? Let's go back to the very idea of the definition of modern humans. As mentioned earlier, Australian Aborigines have a distinct look. This different appearance is not surprising, considering the long history of isolation, perhaps as long as 60,000 years. If we include Australian Aborigines under the Homo sapiens umbrella, should we not include other humans, extinct hominins as well, that also appear different from us? This question is directly relevant to Neanderthals. Neanderthals also have a distinct look, but not quite so different that you could easily pick a Neanderthal out of a crowd. The appearance of Neanderthals, in other words, is well within the range of variation that we see among humans today. The suggestion, then, is that Neanderthals should be included with modern humans. Furthermore, recent research shows that Neanderthals and modern humans interbred and produced viable offspring. As a consequence, Neanderthal genes are present in human populations all over the world. Is it correct to divide these two groups into different species? The debate about whether to call Neanderthals Homo neanderthalensis or Homo sapiens neanderthalensis continues. Did humans really originate only in Africa? The debate between Stringer and Wolpoff has cooled down, but it triggered a more fundamental argument. Not about who should be included under the human umbrella, but about the origin of the human species. Considering the enormous amount of human variation, I cannot help but wonder whether the complete replacement model, which posits that modern humans originated at one point in time from one place, replacing everyone else, even could be correct. My position is represented by a different model. I think modern humans originated not in one place, but from various places. I think modern humans did not appear as a single population that then spread across the globe, but rather as different populations in different regions that encountered one another as they moved around, and intermixed genetically, evolving as one species. And this process resulted in the vast range of variation that we see today among humans in different places, even though they are all members of the species Homo sapiens. This model is called the multi-regional evolution model, proposed in 1984 by Milford Wolpoff, Xinshi Wu at the Institute of Vertebrate Paleontology and Paleoanthropology, IVPP, and the late Ellen G. Thorne at the Australian National University. The model's argument, that Neanderthals and modern humans interacted, interbred through gene flow, and continued to evolve as a single species, is also compatible with the recent research in genetics. Until now, we have talked about our ancestral relatives near and far, and their beginnings and endings. But we do not know even basic information about the rise of Homo sapiens. Of all the questions and problems to be solved related to human evolution, Perhaps the most interesting and difficult one involves ourselves. Extra. Science and politics. In the 1990s, when the debate about the origins of modern humans between the proponents of the complete replacement model and those of the multi-regional evolution model was at its peak, the situation ultimately became political. Or perhaps it already was. The proponents of each side implicitly attacked the other side as racist. Supporters of the complete replacement model argued that modern humans recently originated in Africa, and therefore that the enormous range of variation we see among different people traces its origin to recent human evolution. We are all brothers and sisters under the skin. Those on the side of the multi-regional evolution model argued that human species was not divided into different races, but instead has undergone continuous genetic exchange and interbreeding. We have been brothers and sisters for a very long time. They also argued that originating recently in Africa as a new species, and then spreading all over the world and replacing other hominins without intermixing, implies a worldwide bloodbath as humans drove all others to extinction. An argument that plays racist fears against Africans and colonialism against indigenous peoples. This exchange took place not in published papers, but in seminars and private conversations, off the record. The heated debate, which went beyond empirical support of the data and was influenced by political orientation and sensitivity, reveals that scholars, who have been trained to engage in debates based on cool logic and firm data, are still only human themselves. Chapter 22. Are humans still evolving? This is a question I often get when I teach. Many people think that humans are done evolving, that since we've accomplished culture and civilization, we are no longer subject to biological evolution. People believe that humans have become so advanced as to transcend our biological dimension. Leslie White, an anthropologist from the 1960s, wrote, "Culture is the extrasomatic means of adaptation for the human organism." This means that humans adapt to the environment through culture. According to this view, as culture and civilization advance, humans will adapt to the environment through tools rather than their bodies. For example, when it is cold, we turn on central heating rather than developing a thick layer of fat under our skin. As culture continues to advance, the pressures to adapt to the environment through changes to the body are reduced. This makes sense, sort of, but is it true? Have we gone beyond the mechanisms and laws of evolution? This view reminds me of a conversation I had in the 1990s when I was writing my doctoral dissertation. One of my colleagues, a cultural anthropologist, asked me what my thesis was about. I responded that I was looking at the changes in sexual dimorphism in body size differences between sexes in human evolutionary history, through fossil data. Her response surprised me a lot. Difference between sexes? How could you know from looking at bones, since sex is a social construct? This was becoming the mainstream idea in the 1990s, at least in the field of anthropology. People thought that humans were solely cultural beings. Nothing was biological. Some even thought that concepts such as the body and genes were also socio-cultural concepts, not biological. It seemed as if humans were trying to completely separate themselves from biology. Culture accelerates evolution. Although it has been more than 2 million years since hominins started to make stone tools, modern civilization started only after agriculture and animal domestication were established, about 10,000 years ago. With these two innovations, humans could produce food instead of foraging, and productivity increased substantially. The result was a surplus of food that brought with it civilization and social class structures. The rate of culture change appeared to accelerate. As humans were increasingly changed by culture, biological evolution seemed to take a back seat. Some geneticists have argued that the genetic changes in humans over the last 10,000 years have been neither advantageous nor detrimental in adapting to the environment. Therefore, there has been no natural selection. The core concept of Darwinian evolution, the selection of advantageous traits, was brushed aside as insignificant. New research in the 21st century, however, is changing this view. The human genome was sequenced, and the number of sequenced individual genomes is increasing by leaps and bounds. Now we are starting to have enough data to compare different genomes of individual humans. Through this comparison, we can track specific changes that have happened to specific genes. Contrary to the neutral theory, which argues that selection plays a minimal role in genetics, genes that display recent selective changes have been found. Human genes continue to evolve, and surprisingly, the rate of evolution has accelerated with advances in civilization. And the primary factor that has caused these evolutionary changes is culture. One such example is lighter skin. Refer to Chapter 7. Hominins have spent most of their evolutionary history in equatorial East Africa. Near the equator, ultraviolet radiation is strong, and the mutation that produces a lot of melanin to block it therefore had a selective advantage. According to this hypothesis, this is probably why we developed dark skin. Some hominins then spread out of Africa and started to live in the mid-latitude regions, where UV radiation is weaker. This was the period of the Ice Age, and the short, cloudy days meant even weaker sunlight than what is found in the region today. Skin with a lot of melanin that blocked UV rays was disadvantageous at these latitudes. As I mentioned in Chapter 7, UV radiation is necessary for synthesizing vitamin D. Without sufficient vitamin D, the human body cannot metabolize calcium, and a deficiency in calcium leads to bone deformation, which in turn threatens survival and reproduction. Consequently, a mutation that minimizes or eliminates melanin production was advantageous for the people living in mid-latitude regions, resulting in light skin. This is the vitamin D hypothesis. If this hypothesis is correct, hominins likely developed light skin soon after they left Africa and started to live in mid-latitude regions about 2 million years ago. Because skin color is not preserved in fossils, fossilized data cannot tell us when light skin started. The answer comes from genetics. One of the genes that plays an important role in skin color was discovered in 1999. Today, we know that more than 10 genes are associated with pigmentation in the skin. Interestingly, the frequency distribution of those genes is different by continent. The same shade of skin color may have a different combination of skin color genes, depending on the continent where it appears. Light skin in Europeans and light skin in Asians, for example, have resulted from different collections of genes. The light skin in Europeans first appeared 5,000 years ago, which is much later than the time when hominins first left Africa to go north into Europe. Considering that the first migration out of Africa occurred almost 2 million years ago, 5,000 years ago is incredibly recent. The long gap in time between the exodus from Africa and the appearance of light skin implies that the vitamin D hypothesis does not explain everything. David Reich and his team of researchers at Harvard University, who discovered that light skin appeared recently, propose an alternative hypothesis. They suggest that perhaps after humans started living in the mid-latitude regions, they continued their diet of meat and fish through hunting and foraging. This diet was rich in vitamin D, so there was no need to synthesize vitamin D through skin. And since eliminating melanin was therefore not important, a light skin mutation was not particularly advantageous. When agriculture started about 10,000 years ago, however, there was a substantial change in humans' way of life. Instead of fish and meat, grain became the staple diet, and vitamin D was no longer sufficiently supplied through food. As a result, it became advantageous to synthesize vitamin D through ultraviolet radiation. Now the light skin that let the UV radiation through for vitamin D synthesis was more advantageous than the dark skin that blocked the UV rays, leading to the prevalence of white skin. This is an example of a cultural change, agriculture, leading to a biological change, an increase in the frequency of white skin, through natural selection. Culture did not take the place of biology. On the contrary, culture accelerated biological evolution. In fact, the idea of accelerated human evolution was already circulating among paleoanthropologists who were studying changes in bone morphology in the 1970s. In comparing European skeletons from the Upper Paleolithic and the Mesolithic, David Freyer of the University of Kansas, for example, discovered that the rate of change in limb bone length was faster in the Mesolithic sample, which came after the Upper Paleolithic. This idea still did not become widely accepted at that time, however, because the prevalent hypothesis then was that culture and civilization slowed the evolutionary rate. But now, several studies have found natural selection contributing to recent evolution in humans. There's even a book on the subject, The 10,000-Year Explosion, by Gregory Cochran and Henry Harpending, both at the University of Utah, which came out in 2009. Medical advances accelerate evolution. Compared with the situation in the Pleistocene, over the last 5,000 years, humans have gone through evolutionary changes 100 times faster than previous hominins did. Gregory Cochran, Henry Harpending, and John Hawkes, then also at the University of Utah, now at the University of Wisconsin, argue that several factors have played a role in this acceleration. First, population increase is a big reason for rapid evolution. This is a refreshing perspective. 10,000 years ago, with advances in agriculture, human population increased explosively, and so did the number of mutations. With the same mutation rate, an increase in population means an increase in the number of mutations. Since the number of mutations is related to genetic diversity, increases in mutations mean an increase in genetic diversity. Diversity, variation, is the raw material of evolution. A high level of diversity can fuel more rapid evolution. Genetic exchanges between different populations also enabled evolution. Hominins from early on have continually exchanged genes among different populations. When agriculture was developed 10,000 years ago, however, nation-states were established, and large-scale wars and migrations started to happen. As large groups of humans began to traverse the Eurasian and African continents, the number of exchanges increased explosively, and so did genetic diversity. The development of modern medicine also played a role in generating diversity. People who would not previously have survived could now live long and transfer their genes to the next generation. For example, an extremely nearsighted person like myself, who may have lived a very short life if born in a Neanderthal or an early agricultural society, can now enjoy a long and productive life. Finally, the breathtakingly rapid increase in human diversity triggered a new pattern of variation. Regionality. A genetic adaptation to high altitude, for example, was discovered among people living in Tibet. It was a mutation in the gene called EPAS1. This mutation originated 1,000 years ago and spread so fast that it was called the fastest evolving gene in the world. New environments have brought forth cultures and civilizations that are uniquely adaptive. The combination of diverse environments and diverse cultures has led to diverse sets of traits and more rapid evolution. Consequently, human morphology has become more complex and more specifically adaptive. Foreseeing a diverse future. We often think that evolution happens slowly and gradually, little by little, inconspicuously. Evolution, however, can also take place with terrifying rapidity. We can easily see examples of ultra-fast evolution in agricultural products, farm animals, and pets. They have all been selectively bred to have the form we want, and the resulting variation in different breeds and crops has occurred in the last 10,000 years. If it's possible for plants and animals, then it's possible for humans too. In evolution, advantage and benefit are not inherent and absolute values. A new trait that accidentally happens to be useful for reproduction or adaption to the environment at that moment is advantageous and beneficial. But that exact trait may be disadvantageous in a different environment. There is no such thing as an absolutely and inherently advantageous trait, nor is there an absolutely and inherently damaging trait. As biological organisms, we cannot escape the forces and mechanisms of evolution. Humans evolve. But at the same time, humans are unique in that they can influence their evolutionary trajectory through self-made culture and civilization. None of the traits that humans possess are absolutely advantageous or beneficial, but humans have the ability to apply any trait toward their interest. What's the best thing that humans equipped with such power could do? Perhaps it would be to protect and nurture the environment of the Earth, along with the organisms with which we share it. What a single human being can do may be minuscule. Together, however, we have explored unknown continents, developed sophisticated cultures, and evolved diverse forms. Taken together, the small actions of each human have added up to monumental achievements for humankind. Extra. Ever-evolving wisdom teeth. The third molar, the wisdom tooth, offers a great example of a complex change in variation that is due to advances in medicine. As cooking culture advanced, humans came to prefer soft and well-cooked food. With less chewing, the mandible, jawbone, grew smaller, and the gums also receded. Sometimes upper and lower teeth were not aligned. In other words, there was malocclusion, and the wisdom teeth often had no room to come in. Impacted or crooked wisdom teeth are vulnerable to caries and periodontitis, and when the infection spreads to the whole body, it can even be fatal, or at least create debilitating pain. It is better, that is, selectively advantageous, not to have the wisdom teeth, so it was expected that a mutation for lack of wisdom teeth might spread through human populations. When anthropologists examined prehistoric populations, there was indeed a trend toward an increase in the frequency of third molar agenesis, missing third molars. With advances in modern dentistry, a new situation is unfolding. Now that wisdom teeth can be extracted when problematic, there is no selective advantage for not making wisdom teeth. In the future, I predict that there will be no increase in the people born with the mutation not to make wisdom teeth. Who knows? There may even be an increase in people with wisdom teeth. The point is, we are still evolving, often in unpredictable ways. Epilogue 1. Precious Humanity. In August 2014, a regular reader posted on my Facebook page, inviting me to participate in an online gratitude relay. It was a fad at the time. A person posts three things to be thankful for, then nominates the next person to continue. Naturally, I tried to think of things to be thankful for that had happened during human evolution, and soon I realized it was not an easy task. There were many things to be thankful for, but all had strings attached. So I started a list. First on the list was walking upright. When we started walking on two legs, our two arms became free to make tools and to carry things and babies. We can't forget about the babies. New hominin mothers no longer had fur for the babies to cling to. Mothers' two arms held the babies tight and firm over long distances. But bipedalism had a price. Lower back pain became a common problem. Those of us with experience know all too well that when your lower back is in pain, there is nothing to be done but lie down, immobilized. There was another price, too. An overworked heart. The heart has to send a large volume of blood to the top of the body, against gravity. It is under chronic stress. The second thing on my list of things to be thankful for was our big brain. Our big brain is literally our namesake. Homo sapiens is labeled with and defined by our intelligence. Having a big brain is important for our identity as humans. With big brains and the knowledge contained in them, hominins could process staggering amounts of information, chiefly, at first, to procure a lot of animal fat and protein, which were important in an always competitive and increasingly harsh environment. Big brains allowed hominins to forge and maintain countless beneficial social relationships as well. But to give birth to hominin newborns equipped with brains bigger than our pelvic width, mothers have had to bear bone-breaking pain. Moreover, every childbirth comes with a mortality risk on top of the excruciating pain. Third, I noted being thankful for our longevity. Hominins that lived longer were able to see the birth of their grandchildren. With the help of grandmothers, Hominins could then take care of two or three children at the same time. A previously impossible feat for a species whose children demand such a high parental investment from the moment when they're born. With three overlapping generations, more information could be stored and transmitted to the next generation. The continuation of this longevity trend, however, has led to a situation today in which we have more elderly and fewer youth to care for them, placing a greater economic burden on society. As I thought about the next two things on my list, agriculture and animal domestication, I felt depressed and perhaps not quite as thankful. Yes, humans became free in the sense that they no longer had to rely 100% on their foraging skills or the environment to acquire food, and could, in fact, produce as much food as they wanted, even a surplus. Productivity increased, populations exploded, and civilizations expanded. At the same time, however, surplus production led to the privatization of property, and class structures began to develop, along with warfare in which humans killed each other in large numbers for the first time in human history. Moreover, as people abandoned their generational knowledge of ecology and respect for nature, years of crop failures resulted in mass starvation. The concurrent shift to humans and their domesticated animals living in close proximity set up the perfect environment for infectious diseases to jump from animal species to humans, where some became virulent diseases with deadly outcomes. High-density populations became quickly vulnerable to disease epidemics. The price we paid was quite high for the reward of civilization. As I went down the gratitude list, I could not help but feel the gravity of what these achievements have cost humanity. Perhaps there was nothing in human evolution that we could only be thankful for, with no strings attached. Could it be that gratitude and resentment go hand in hand, like two sides of a coin? Then I realized something. Maybe the price paid was so high because what we gained was so precious. Nothing in human evolution has come completely for free. Our present situation is a result of the high price we paid throughout our history. And humanity's progress is truly precious. We must remember, however, that others also paid the price for us. It is not an exaggeration to say that every organism on Earth is paying for us. If we extended our gratitude relay invitation to what Qin Yongyun called the disappearing ones, they might respectfully decline. For them, gratitude is an unimaginable luxury, one they cannot afford when they face the planet's most formidable predator, humans. We have become the strongest and most dangerous form of life in this world. Now it is time for us to take responsibility for the disappearing world that is paying the price for us. Let's take action. Songhee Lee. Epilogue 2. An Invitation to an Unfamiliar World of Paleoanthropology. This book is based on a collection of essays published in Gwahak Dong-a, a Korean science magazine for the general public, from February 2012 to December 2013, edited and with added materials. I first thought of this series after I worked with Songhee Lee on an article about Neanderthals for a special issue. I had always been fascinated by human evolution and paleoanthropology, and was working on a piece about Neanderthals for a special issue of the magazine in March 2011, as it had just been discovered that Neanderthals shared genes with modern humans. I had been pursuing this topic ever since attending a lecture by and communicating with Svante Paabo from the Max Planck Institute in Germany 2 years before. Korea has very few experts in the field of paleoanthropology. I could not find many sources to consult, and had just started to look for experts outside Korea. In my search for writings on this topic, I found an article in Korean that reviewed the current state of affairs in human evolution. The author was a paleoanthropologist, a professor at a university in the United States. I sent an email, not entirely sure that I would get a reply, or if I did that it would be the reply I wanted, but I was surprised to receive a prompt and positive response. That was my first encounter with Songhee Lee. After that we communicated by email, and then talked at length about Neanderthals in a series of international phone calls during the Lunar New Year holiday season in quiet Seoul. The special issue was a success, and I resolved to organize a bigger project with her in the future. In the following year, at an editorial meeting, I came up with the idea of publishing a series of columns on the topic of human evolution. I immediately contacted Lee. I was convinced that this series on paleoanthropology and evolution should not take the typical chronological approach. A sequence starting from where and when the first hominins appeared and moving on to how they evolved through time to finally reach the present seemed too predictable. Nothing special. I proposed a unique approach of using an everyday occurrence as a hook to dig deeper into the evolution. I also wanted the writings to reflect Lee's warm and humorous style, so I asked her to write in a conversational style rather than a rigid scholarly style, in order to reach a wider audience. The first several columns were extremely important for securing a lasting readership, so a lot of thinking and care went into them. When I received the first essay from Lee, I read it over and over again. I worked late into the night, thinking about how best to present the comfortable yet sharp content of the article to the readers. As the editor and organizer of the series, I perhaps put more love into these essays than I would into my own writing. This beautiful collaboration of exchanging inspiration continued for 2 years, a length of time rarely seen in the world of magazine series in Korea. As soon as the first column was out, I was approached by Donga Ilbo, a daily newspaper, to start a series for its weekend edition. I edited the essays to work better for the newspaper's readership. They were well received. Simultaneous publication of the series in both the magazine and the newspaper continued for a year, giving us an opportunity to reach a wide range of readers. These essays, the product of so much love and attention, are finally together in a book. It is now time to reach yet another new readership. I would love to see Lee's inspiring writing reach and inspire many more. Shin Young Yoon. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Emily Wu Zeller. Copyright 2015 by Songhee Lee and Shin Young Yoon. Published by arrangement with W.W. Norton & Company, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2018 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.